As the Americans were waiting to move on, an altercation broke out in their rearmost rank. An American had muttered something which a guard did not like. The guard knew English, and he hauled the American out of ranks, knocked him down. The American was astonished. He stood up shakily, spitting blood. He had two teeth knocked out. He had meant no harm by what he said, evidently. Had no idea that the guard would hear and understand. "Why me?" he asked the guard. The guard shoved him back into ranks. "Why you? Why anybody?" he said. When Billy Pilgrim's name was inscribed in the ledger of the prison camp, he was given a number, too, and an iron dog tag in which that number was stamped. A slave laborer from Poland had done the stamping. He was dead now. So it goes. Billy was told to hang the tag around his neck along with his American dog tags, which he did. The tag was like a salt cracker, perforated down its middle so that a strong man could snap it in two with his bare hands. In case Billy died, which he didn't, half of the tag would mark his body and half would mark his grave. After poor Edgar Derby, the high school teacher, was shot in Dresden later on, a doctor pronounced him dead and snapped his dog tag in two. So it goes. Properly enrolled and tagged, the Americans were led through gate after gate again. In 2 days' time, now their families would learn from the International Red Cross that they were alive. Next to Billy was little Paul Lazaro, who had promised to avenge Roland Weary. Lazaro wasn't thinking about vengeance. He was thinking about his terrible bellyache. His stomach had shrunk to the size of a walnut. That dry, shriveled pouch was as sore as a boil. Next to Lazaro was poor, doomed, old Edgar Derby, with his American and German dogs displayed like a necklace on the outside of his clothes. He had expected to become a captain, a company commander, because of his wisdom and age. Now here he was on the Czechoslovakian border at midnight. "Halt," said a guard. The Americans halted. They stood there quietly in the cold. The sheds they were among were outwardly like thousands of other sheds they had passed. There was this difference, though. The sheds had tin chimneys, and out of the chimneys whirled constellations of sparks. A guard knocked on the door. The door was flung open from inside. Light leapt out through the door, escaped from prison at 186,000 miles per second. Out marched 50 middle-aged Englishmen. They were singing, "Hail, hail, the gang's all here," from the Pirates of Penzance. These lusty, ruddy vocalists were among the first English-speaking prisoners to be taken in the Second World War. Now they were singing to nearly the last. They had not seen a woman or a child for 4 years or more. They hadn't seen any birds either. Not even sparrows would come into the camp. The Englishmen were officers. Each of them had attempted to escape from another prison at least once. Now they were here, dead center in a sea of dying Russians. They could tunnel all they pleased. They would inevitably surface within a rectangle of barbed wire, would find themselves greeted listlessly by dying Russians who spoke no English, who had no food or useful information or escape plans of their own. They could scheme all they pleased to hide aboard a vehicle or steal one, but no vehicle ever came into their compound. They could feign illness if they liked, but that wouldn't earn them a trip anywhere either. The only hospital in the camp was a 6-bed affair in the British compound itself. The Englishmen were clean and enthusiastic and decent and strong. They sang boomingly well. They had been singing together every night for years. The Englishmen had also been lifting weights and chinning themselves for years. Their bellies were like washboards. The muscles of their calves and upper arms were like cannonballs. They were all masters of checkers and chess and bridge and cribbage and dominoes and anagrams and charades and ping-pong and billiards as well. They were among the wealthiest people in Europe in terms of food. A clerical error early in the war, when food was still getting through to prisoners, had caused the Red Cross to ship them 500 parcels every month instead of 50. The Englishmen had hoarded these so cunningly that now, as the war was ending, they had 3 tons of sugar, 1 ton of coffee, 1,100 pounds of chocolate, 700 pounds of tobacco, 1,700 pounds of tea, 2 tons of flour, 1 ton of canned beef, 1,200 pounds of canned butter, 1,600 pounds of canned cheese, 800 pounds of powdered milk, and 2 tons of orange marmalade. They kept all this in a room without windows. They had rat-proofed it by lining it with flattened tin cans. They were adored by the Germans, who thought they were exactly what Englishmen ought to be. They made war look stylish and reasonable and fun. So the Germans let them have 4 sheds, though 1 shed would have held them all. And in exchange for coffee or chocolate or tobacco, the Germans gave them paint and lumber and nails and cloth for fixing things up. The Englishmen had known for 12 hours that American guests were on their way. They had never had guests before, and they went to work like darling elves, sweeping, mopping, cooking, baking, making mattresses of straw and burlap bags, setting tables, putting party favors at each place. Now they were singing their welcome to their guests in the winter night. Their clothes were aromatic with the feast they had been preparing. They were dressed half for battle, half for tennis or croquet. They were so elated by their own hospitality and by all the goodies waiting inside that they did not take a good look at their guests while they sang, and they imagined that they were singing to fellow officers fresh from the fray. They wrestled the Americans towards the shed door affectionately, filling the night with manly blather and brotherly rodomontades. They called them Yank, told them, "Good show," promised them that Jerry was on the run, and so on. Billy Pilgrim wondered dimly who Jerry was. Now he was indoors, next to an iron cook stove that was glowing cherry red. Dozens of teapots were boiling there. Some of them had whistles, and there was a witch's cauldron full of golden soup. The soup was thick. Primeval bubbles surfaced it with lethargical majesty as Billy Pilgrim stared. There were long tables set for a banquet. At each place was a bowl made from a can that had once contained powdered milk. A smaller can was a cup. A taller, more slender can was a tumbler. Each tumbler was filled with warm milk. At each place was a safety razor, a washcloth, a package of razor blades, a chocolate bar, 2 cigars, a bar of soap, 10 cigarettes, a book of matches, a pencil, and a candle. Only the candles and the soap were of German origin. They had a ghostly, opalescent similarity. The British had no way of knowing it, but the candles and the soap were made from the fat of rendered Jews and gypsies and fairies and communists and other enemies of the state. So it goes. The banquet hall was illuminated by candlelight. There were heaps of fresh baked white bread on the tables, gobs of butter, pots of marmalade. There were platters of sliced beef from cans. Soup and scrambled eggs and hot marmalade pie were yet to come. And at the far end of the shed, Billy saw pink arches with azure draperies hanging between them, and an enormous clock, and 2 golden thrones, and a bucket and a mop. It was in this setting that the evening's entertainment would take place, a musical version of Cinderella, the most popular story ever told.